You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. And I would like to welcome you to our event on how to improve cybersecurity career and technical education. We all know that cybersecurity represents one of the most important challenges of the digital era. There are malicious actors who've targeted governments, businesses, and civil society seeking confidential information, or organizations and people who engage in outright disruption of digital networks. To deal with these challenges, we need to develop a critical infrastructure workforce that understands cybersecurity and can help protect assets that are vital to our society. Today, we are honored to have two very distinguished members of Congress who are leaders on cybersecurity. First, Congressman Jim Langevin, who serves on the Subcommittee on Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Protection. We actually met many years ago in Rhode Island when he entered public service, and I've been impressed at the amazing career that he has had since that point in time. Congressman Langevin also is co-chair of the Congressional Career and Technical Education Caucus and also co-chair of the Congressional Cybersecurity Caucus. So he is one of our nation's leading authorities on cybersecurity. We also are very pleased to welcome Congressman Glenn Thompson from Pennsylvania. He serves on the Subcommittee on Higher Education and Workforce Training. He was one of the leaders who helped enable the reauthorization of the Perkins Act on Technical Education. So we applaud him for his great work on that issue. He also serves as co-chair of the Congressional Career and Technical Education Caucus. So each of the two members of Congress will make opening remarks outlining their thoughts on cybersecurity education. Then we will have a moderated discussion led by my Brookings colleague, Susan Hennessy. Susan is a senior fellow in governance studies at Brookings and also executive editor of the Lawfare National Security blog. She also directs our new cybersecurity initiative and is helping us think through both the policy and operational challenges in that area. So our first speaker will be Congressman Langevin. So I will turn it over to him. Thank you.
Very good. Darrell, thank you very much for the introduction. It's an honor to be here today at Brookings. I want to thank you all for hosting us and to be with Susan as well. Thanks for moderating, Susan. And it's a real thrill for me to be teaming up once again with my colleague, G.T. Thompson from the great state of Pennsylvania, and he was really the leader and the force behind our collaboration on reauthorizing the Perkins Act that modernized career and technical education at our high schools and post-secondary programs. So, just an honor and thrill to be teaming up with G.T. once again on this topic. And I have some prepared remarks to just kind of frame the issue, and then we'll get into the Q&A part of it. This topic of cybersecurity and career and technical education brings together two real passions of mine. Both of these interests came from distinct experiences that I had as a member of Congress back several years ago. Starting off in 2007, I chaired the subcommittee on Homeland Security that had jurisdiction over cyber threats. And I can remember my staff coming to me one day and telling me that I had to get a classified briefing about a significant vulnerability that two researchers out at Idaho National Labs had found to our electric grid. And basically, we arranged the briefing in a secure space, and we started by talking about the issue, but then they showed a video of this diesel generator operating normally, and all of a sudden it starts spinning up beyond its capacity and started shaking and basically as the seconds tick by, it wind up basically blowing itself up and because it had exceeded its capacity. And what caused this was basically a simple piece of malicious code that was inserted into the generator's logic system. The Aurora test, as it's now known, really opened my eyes to the physical damage that could be caused by a cyber incident, and the subsequent lack of concern from the owners and operators of the electric grid and safety of its delivery systems really convinced me that here Congress had a significant role to play to address this vulnerability, this problem. A year later, on another topic, we were in one of the worst recessions in our nation's history, and 2007, 2008, and as my constituents had really struggled with a dismal economy, I would, as I usually would, go and tour businesses throughout my district, particularly in the manufacturing field, and I asked them, you know, almost afraid to ask, but you know, when do you think you're going to feel confident enough that you're going to start hiring again? And in my experience, especially at manufacturing facilities, that the answer I got time and again was, we're actually hiring right now in many positions, but we're finding it a real difficult challenge to find workers with the right skills to do the jobs that that are available. So the skills gap really prompted me to look into policies that could bridge the gap between what industry really needs and what our education system was teaching. And in this case, I found that we already had a proven solution. That's a CTE, Career and Technical Education. So, ironically, it took me really a decade now to bring these two issues together that I could work on jointly. But eventually, after countless speeches where I really exhorted people to take a fresh look at CTE, after all, advanced manufacturing jobs today don't at all really resemble the manufacturing jobs of our parents and our grandparents. It's really the next generation, and I really started to wonder how much people entering these exciting new companies knew about cybersecurity and its importance. And the answer that I found was it was really very little, you know, it's not really surprising. So we've long faced a gap, if you will, in OT and IT. And that is it's a difference in maturity between cybersecurity risk postures of operational technology networks, which encompass industrial control systems or SCADA systems, and other systems that have real-world physical impact, and the information technology networks that have laptops and tablets and smartphones that we're more familiar with. So cybersecurity awareness in the IT world has increased pretty dramatically, and a lot of companies that are now taking steps to educate their employees, whether through traditional training or more novel approaches like making them aware of phishing emails. But what really got my attention now is that we're far behind in the OT world, and part of the reason is historical. It's only in the last really 10 to 15 years that OT systems started to be connected to the internet, and therefore are now vulnerable. So these types of systems they brought great efficiencies to things like power plants or the electric grid, but with those connections to these OT systems now to the internet in particular, if they're on the internet, it brings great vulnerabilities. And so part of this, as we found, and why it's not a high priority to security, is due to the gap in skills training that GTE and I are trying to attempt now through the by introducing the Cybersecurity Skills and Integration Act of this year, H.R. 1592. So basically, in high-risk safety critical sectors, whether it's telecommunications or manufacturing or healthcare, workforce without basic cybersecurity skills, in my opinion, can be very dangerous, and so we're trying to basically address these topics right now, close that gap, we need to be successful. So, you know, I'll kind of wind up with this, And while it's important that we have certainly cybersecurity experts to help protect our different sectors, it's also important that every worker, especially those dealing with OT, understand their role in keeping our systems secure. And this may be as simple as changing a username and a password or reporting phishing attempts, but it's crucial for our homeland security. And just to, by way of an example, when you think of many fields, whether it's electricians or other fields, they're steeped in this culture of physical safety. You'd never see an electrician leave a door to a high voltage distribution panel unlocked, for example, but you may never see he or she plug in. They wouldn't think about anything about at all walk away without closing that off. But you may see him or her plug in a network cable and walk away and not be conscious of that security, so and that safety issue. So what's clear is that most cybersecurity experts I talk to with this is that plugging in that smart device without changing the default credentials or alerting the network team is inherently unsafe, and we obviously need to address this challenge, raise the awareness and the skills training so that as they're being trained in this security and safety culture, that cybersecurity is a part of that. So that kind of frames where we're going, what we're trying to do, and I'll turn it back over to Susan or to Gigi. So thank you.
Susan, thank you. Thank you all of you for coming out today for this. I mean, this is a great turnout, and it is so important that we are paying attention to this issue. Thank you to Daryl and Susan for your leadership and facilitating here. And thanks to my friend Jim here. We've got reputations, so don't let them know that we're working together so well. We've always worked well together. Jim's just a dear friend of mine and a colleague, and we've got a long history of legislative successes for many years when it comes to skills-based education, when it comes to restoring rungs on the ladder of opportunity. And so really proud to be working with him. He brings in this particular partnership, the true expertise on cybersecurity with his background and the things that he's worked on. So I've learned a lot from this man, and this is a great partnership for us. Cybersecurity is something that impacts most Americans. I would say it impacts today every American, unless you live off the grid, no phone, you keep your money under your pillow or under your mattress. That was probably the only exception where you potentially could not be impacted by a cybersecurity issue. It is that broad and that important of an issue. It is the intersection of technology, of innovation, and quite frankly, the need for efficiency in what we do, and workforce needs. It's all those things. It also is a cross-section of opportunity and risk. I used to love it that every so often there'd be a new phone with new technology. It's hard to call them phones today because of everything they do. They say there's more computing capability than what those first astronauts that went to the moon. And I used to love that until after my son was wounded with an improvised explosive device in Iraq, and it became a stark reality that every time that I enjoyed a new function and feature on my cell phone, that there was a terrorist using some of that technology to somehow more in an evil way, but an innovative way, detonate IEDs. And so technology comes with, it's an opportunity, but there is risk to manage. And that's what really is probably the short definition of cybersecurity with what we're doing. The average citizen needs to be aware of bad actors who would obtain their sensitive information, viruses, spyware. You all know this. I mean, it runs the gamut. Cyber intrusion runs the gamut of privacy, just privacy issues, which are so important today, of protecting our information, and there's so much available on the virtual highway today, so to speak, to unethical business practices, to cyber crimes, to cyber terrorism. I mean, it's kind of the world that we live in today, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. Most citizens are utilizing the internet for personal banking and cyber commerce and tele-education and telehealth, and so much of our lives are streaming today. And so, there's issues that we need to safeguard, and we need the workforce to do that. So let me cut to the chase. We need a workforce that understands cybersecurity at all levels, absolutely all levels. And we need men and women who have the skill sets to be leaders in security. I wish the people, the individuals out there that would do cyber crimes, cyber terrorism, compromising people's privacy, exercising unethical business practices using cyber means, I wish they would use their energy and their knowledge for good. This world would be a whole lot better place. But unfortunately, that kind of evil exists. And so that's why we need to make sure that we're encouraging and recruiting the best and the brightest when it comes to cybersecurity skills. That is our defense. And it's not easy because, as you all know, it's redefined as technology changes and improves and it's used in different ways. So it's really a battle. It's an effort that requires us to be proactive, to anticipate. And we get that with the number one asset in that effort is a qualified and trained workforce. There's no doubt about it. I've been working on career and technical education for more than a decade now. Last Congress, we were able to pass a bill I was proud to lead, and Jim's support, the original co-sponsor. And I was proud to be with the president on July 31st this past year when he signed in the Oval Office the Strengthening Career and Technical Education for the 21st Century Act. Now, the cool part about that bill is, if you turn on cable news network, all you see is division and friction. And, that bill was voted on six times between the House and the Senate. And in six votes, not one person voted against it during six times. But we didn't see that reported on cable news network. I guess it wasn't newsworthy. I think it was, because I think it also shows how much. And Jim and I have done some radio shows in the morning with C-SPAN, and they're used to the Republican line, the Democratic line, the independent line. It's like throwing, and typically if you watch that, it's like grenades going back and forth. We're on, all people want to, it doesn't matter what they're registered. Every line, they're just talking about how career and technical education has made a difference in their lives, yeah, or their children's lives or their grandchildren's lives. And that's why, and now that we're taking to the next step, which is really in a lot of different ways, but in particular today, we're talking about cybersecurity and that skill set. There's more than 7 million jobs that are open and available out there today. And certainly, and one of the greatest threats or challenges, as Jim talked about, is the skills gap. But we have accomplished a great deal within the legislation that has now been signed by the president to not just reauthorize the Perkins Act, but to reform career and technical education so that we're actually focused on restoring rungs on a ladder of opportunity and looking at in-demand positions. And there's very few that are probably as in-demand going forward as cybersecurity, because it impacts every industry. Every industry can be vulnerable. Really proud to work with Jim on that. Our most recent bill is, as you mentioned, H.R. 1592, which is a Cybersecurity Skills Integration Act, a great competitive grant program that does the kind of things we've been working on, encouraging that partnership between employers and educators, that public-private partnership to address in-demand skill sets. And with more than 16 critical infrastructure sectors in the country, we really have to prepare our next generation of learners to have the most sophisticated and comprehensive educational programs to protect our nation's dire assets, systems, our networks, operational technology, those control systems that are part of almost every manufacturer today. I mean, we have fewer people working in manufacturing today, but it's because of technology. Actually, manufacturing is a larger part of our gross domestic product than any time in history, and it's because of technology. So this is about managing that opportunity and the risk that comes together. And so Let me just close there. Looking forward to questions and discussions, and just say once again, thank you for your interest in this. That is extremely important given the significance of cybersecurity, really in all aspects of our lives.
So thank you to both of the congressmen for joining us here today. I like to start every cybersecurity panel by attempting to scare the audience a little bit. I think
That's
your
easy.
Staffs would agree that you are both facing overwhelming and urgent legislative agendas right now. It takes a lot to get congressional attention on a particular issue. And so I'm curious, as you, whatever you've introduced now, this Cybersecurity Education Integration Act, what are you concerned about? What is your fear if we don't have this kind of intervention? Sort of what is the long-term landscape if we don't address these issues now? And I'd put that to both of you.
So just yesterday we had a hearing on the safety and security at chemical facilities, for example. And I asked, and they talk about the safety training, the protocols that they have in place, and how they're their workforce needs to be, part of the safety training, so that they're doing the right things when they're managing these facilities and servicing the facilities, making sure they're running at optimal capacity. And so I asked, so what type of cybersecurity training? And this was the person who was directly responsible for representing the workforce. And I asked, what type of cybersecurity training do their workers get? And he said, I'm really not the cybersecurity expert, so I really can't answer that question. And that's kind of goes to the heart of what I'm most concerned about. That's where the bad things can happen. I mean, you'd be obviously worried about making sure that the physical systems couldn't release chemicals into the atmosphere, and that's going to cause significant harm to not only the workers there, but the surrounding population. And what we're saying is that the people that now service these not only need to be concerned about making sure that the valves are replaced, or that when they're before they're worn out, or the safety systems are up to standard, but also now these remote systems in OT systems, operational technology, that have sensors on them and such, and can be managed remotely, that they have to be secured when they're serviced and they're installed. Or the bad thing that could have happened before by some physical activity, like an explosion or some physical hands-on sabotage, now it can be done potentially remotely. So we want to make sure the people that are installing and servicing these systems are cyber-conscious and cyber-trained.
I think it's comprehensive, just like Jim said, but it's comprehensive concerns. I mean, just last week I got an email on my personal email that said, you have been hacked. Send me $100 US and we won't do anything. And I'm thinking, well, you can hack my email and take a look at it. There's not much there to see, You're not getting $100. It's the cyber crimes like that. It's certainly unethical advantage that's taken either by countries, by nations, or by businesses, cyber espionage. It runs the course. Cyber intrusion runs, when you think of the critical infrastructures we have. I'll focus on, you mentioned manufacturing. Let me focus on agriculture. I was vice chair of the Agriculture Committee, a senior member on the Agriculture Committee. And when I look at our food processing, not only food production as well as our farms are wired. I mean, we are administering, we are measuring soil health as a tractor runs over using a GPS device that doesn't really need to be driven, some of these tractors. It's measuring soil health and administering pesticides, insecticides, nutrients. And it's all done basically virtually, and processing plants where we're talking food. So how sensitive is temperature when it comes to making sure that there's no variance, that we have not just high quality, affordable, but safe food? And so the exposure anywhere where we have this technology that is now online and vulnerable. You just take one of those, a transportation issue, a manufacturing issue, an agriculture issue, a defense issue, a financial services issue. That's the stuff that these novels are written about, actually. Yeah.
That was even scarier answers than I had expected you would give me. So
sorry
so
about that.
Welcome to our world.
Yeah, that's right.
So moving to sort of the specific legislation, Congressman Langevin, what is the goal of this particular piece of legislation? What are you hoping to accomplish with it?
So we want to create, again, I believe heavily, and GT does as well, on the public-private partnership. And so the whole goal of our the Perkins Reauthorization Act is to make sure that there was better alignment between what we're teaching in our classrooms and what our real-world needs are in business. Because the Perkins hadn't been reauthorized for 10 years, mm-hmm. and so we teamed up to bring that reauthorization through Congress. And so it ensures closer alignment between what we're teaching in schools and what businesses need, and it ensures that businesses obviously have a seat at the table. What we want to do in this with the new Cybersecurity Skills Training Act is to make sure that that we develop curriculum so that our people in these CTE fields that are dealing with safety systems and such and dealing with OT systems are properly trained. Right now, the programs don't really exist, and so it would be focused on a grant program, creating demonstration programs that would create curriculum that where there's a partnership between academia and businesses. So it would be encouraging that kind of collaboration would be a $10 million authorization to develop the programs. And they would be taught at the post-secondary level. And the goal, of course, would be that eventually, once the curriculum is developed, that the curriculum would eventually migrate down and be used at the secondary school program level as the kids are getting trained. But these people right now that we're focusing on first, places like CCRI, Community College of Rhode Island, teaming up with the Electric Boat, for example, they're training people to go into field of building submarines. On submarines, they're going to have sensors attached to monitoring safety systems and such. We want to make sure similar fields that they're trained also in cybersecurity, so that they're installing sensors that they're going to actually be safety, both virtually and there'll be safety and focused in both both the systems and the programs that they're connecting.
And Congressman Thompson, I'm hoping you can sort of walk us through how the bill operates, right? So if you're planning on changing university behavior,
sure.
how does it work?
Well, first of all, let me just say, when you think of career and technical education, it's not necessarily, we're probably not talking about a four-year degree. It's not to say that somebody won't eventually, I look at it this way, if I'm going to hire an engineer, I think the best possible engineer I could hire is somebody who perhaps even at a secondary level had gotten some skills-based education in welding and draftsmanship. And if they have those basic skills and they understand how things get built, they're going to make an amazing engineer after they go on. So it's kind of a ladder of opportunity to be able to climb. And so there's no one particular place for this. It could be a career and technical education school. It could be empowering an employer who has cybersecurity needs. We put within the Perkins reauthorization that we did, that was again signed in July into law, we really built some strong, returning to a strong, robust apprenticeship program that where the employers are really at the table there. We tried to bring the people who signed the front of a paycheck, not the back of a paycheck, to the table so that we actually educate to the needs. And we also provide an ability to pivot for those educational institutions. Before, you could have an emerging need in your community. Maybe it's somebody who grew up in one of our congressional districts. We could cite a number of examples of those. And they wanted to come back home because they had gone off and done great things. They created these big businesses, put maybe thousands, if not hundreds, of jobs. And they wanted to come back, and they wanted to build a business. And I've seen examples of this. And you know what their number one need is? It's qualified and trained workforce. And so they do reach out to our educational institutions, And they'd say, you know what, I'll create 500 jobs if I can find the qualified and trained employees. Well, before our law got signed, to get approvals for starting a new program, that was at the speed of bureaucracy. You know, it would be sometimes years until it's like turning an aircraft carrier in a typhoon. You know, it usually doesn't work. But now under the underlying law that we started with, we created the ability to pivot. So that foundational will be very helpful for what we're working on now with cybersecurity, because the demand's there. It's obvious. And now communities, whether it's community colleges, career and technical education, business industries, all sizes that want to do apprenticeship, do their own training programs, will now have the ability to step, you know, kind of step up those programs.
So, Congressman Langevin, are there examples of programs or universities that are already doing this well, or is this sort of uncharted territory and where you're trying something that's sort of wholly new?
Yeah, so a lot of ways it's uncharted, but we look at NIST, for example. This is the program that we would use as a kind of foundation. The NIST, it's the NICE framework. It stands for the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education. And basically, it would use this as a model, as a foundation, to build a program going forward. But it puts real context to what the need is out there. And as these curriculums developed and they're doing career and technical education development programs, that we incorporate that cyber element in it. So NIST is where we look as the primary resource as the program is developed, but there is a model that we would start with.
And our district lines were redrawn by some judges. That's a whole other session we can talk about this past year. But before that, I had the privilege of working representing in Erie County, a university, a small college actually, and they had two campuses. They actually get into workforce development, not just a traditional four-year path. And we've got the Tom Ridge Cybersecurity School there. And so they were really cutting new ground, recognizing the need for that skill set. But I would argue, if you look at some of even our traditional career and technical education programs, and that's the beauty of career and technical education, the tools of career and technical education is, you know, it's the things people normally think about. It's welders and hammers and wrenches, but it's also paintbrushes and scissors and stethoscopes and keyboards and industrial control systems and operational technology applications. I mean, it's just so varied that, I mean, if you go into a heating, ventilation, air conditioning program with high school kids today, they're working with controls that are wireless. I mean, almost, many of the traditional programs out there, you know, that this technology and innovation has been innovated because for efficiency purposes and convenience of the consumer into those programs. And those kids will say, and then adults, because career and technical education is for everybody at any age, we envision that as a portal. You go in and get what you need, and you come out, you get a better job, you get a raise, you better support your family. Those skill sets also have to not just have the skill to deal with the opportunity, but we need to educate them to the risk.
So this is sort of framed as a pilot program. I assume that means that if it works, it will be expanded. How do you think about measuring success? How will you know if this program has worked?
Well, a part of it is witnessing it. You know, it's expecting. Look for those reports back. We'll lean heavily on the Department of Labor, on the Department of Education, to, you know, for Department of Commerce. You know, they should all be monitoring with this concern. Actually, quite frankly, the Department of Homeland Security ought to be looking at this as well because of the cybersecurity threat. So our expectation, I think, would be that it's implemented. And then I learned a long time ago, it's not sufficient just to write and successfully get what I think is righteous legislation signed by the president, but I don't ever trust turning it over to unelected bureaucrats without some oversight. Mm-hmm. Because I've seen situations where, well, in one of my first bills dealt with telemedicine and how the Department of Defense completely misinterpreted what my thoughts of telemedicine were. The step back, they called me up one day and they said, Congressman, you got to love this. We're fully implemented. We're going to be able to save lives because we're going to provide more access to health care through telemedicine for active duty military reserve and guard. They said, this is perfect. All these soldiers need to do is show up at a fort or an installation and we'll hook them up with telemedicine. And I'm thinking, you people missed the boat. I want them to be able to do that when they're depressed at their dining room table. And you know what? And that oversight made a difference. So I think that's part of it is makes when we're done with this, we're not going to be done with it. We have to provide oversight. And hopefully we can have the future goal, which would be great, would have hearings, you know, to provide some transparency on how things are going, have people coming in to witness, you know, what difference has this made for an industry? What difference has this made for somebody for, you know, better life opportunity?
Right. I think that's oversight is exactly right. We'll follow up on this, making sure that, I guess I would look and say, in addition to the oversight, looking at if the NIST framework and standards are adopted throughout the CTE training programs, where there's any type of a IT or OT training that's involved. So GT and I, we teamed up on and modernizing the career and technical education programs. And again, whether it's in advanced manufacturing, working with robotics, whether it's plumbing and pipe fitting. And so those have been, we're going to make sure that those are modernized and up to what industry needs. But then anything that touches also on an IT or OT training that, again, cybersecurity is built into it. I think we're all becoming more and more aware of the fact that we are part of the solution when it comes to dealing with IT. And most people know that, okay, you should have a strong password on your system, should have malware protection on your computers, that you're downloading your security patches. Don't click on unknown links or download, opening up attachments that are sent to you by an unknown source. You know, basically, a high percentage of the vulnerabilities in cyberspace can be addressed by practicing good cyber hygiene. And so now we're also addressing the gap in not just IT security but in OT security. So these systems that cause a physical action that, again, used to be done kind of just locally, now are managed remotely. So opening up or closing valves, causing a generator now to kind of spin up or spin down depending on the load that's needed. These OT systems are now connected and networked in a lot of ways. Hopefully they're not necessarily always connected to the internet, but they're going to be connecting to something and allows for that the remote management. We want to make sure that the people that are installing and servicing these systems have cybersecurity as a forethought and not just an afterthought.
So I'm curious why you think that the private sector isn't getting this right on their own, right? These companies are in sort of the OT sector. They're the ones who bear the immediate cost of sort of a cybersecurity event. And so why is it that you think that we aren't seeing sort of that prioritization of cybersecurity in that field?
A lot of it's because the curriculum doesn't really exist and hasn't been a focus. That's why we're saying that we're going to make this a priority. We're going to work with industry and academia to develop these pilot programs and pilot training and make sure that curriculum is incorporated. There's this hope or belief maybe it's not going to happen to us, and that's one of the things I found in the electric grid, for example, that there was a sense that we've got this, and we've installed, or we have strong cybersecurity measures in place. When you peel back the onion, we found that that's not really accurate. Now it's getting a lot better than where it was back when I first started on this field of cybersecurity. But it's a work in progress, and as technology changes and improves, we need to keep up with the changes and keep up with the threats. And we're also looking at, again, closer partnerships between critical infrastructure and Department of Homeland Security. All these things are a work in progress. We're getting to a better place, but it's, you know, we can't rest on our laurels either.
Yeah, you need workforce. I mean, that's, I think you'd be hard pressed to find anyone who, in any of the industries we've mentioned, who are not, I mean, that are not successful, knowing that the cybersecurity concerns has to be something that they're talking about. And quite frankly, they need a qualified and trained workforce. And so, so this, and it's a fairly recent advent when you think about it, in terms of something that's a decade or decades long in terms of development, but it's certainly a part of almost every, I can't think of too many industries that wouldn't be impacted today.
So you've mentioned sort of the number of sectors that this bears on, everything from agriculture to to health to defense. Your bill uses the DHS definition of critical infrastructure. One sort of critique of that definition as it relates to DHS is that it encompasses so much that if everything is critical, nothing is critical. And so as you start to approach these issues as a matter of congressional priority in a world of sort of limited resources, how do you think about defining that sector, for that prioritized attention?
Well, I don't think you can limit it because there is so many vulnerabilities today. I mean, sadly, I'm sitting here with two cell phones and multiple emails and all the stuff that go with it in my pocket today, not by choice, but by necessity, because that's the way the world is today. And so it's overwhelming from the perspective that you described, that there are so many sectors that would be a part of the 16, I think perhaps officially is a number that comes to mind. But what is the common thread? What is the common thread on this? The common thread is having someone who is available, that is qualified and trained, that anyone in any industry, whether it's those 16 or others, could go out and recruit. I mean, the great news is these are great jobs. The bad news is we don't have enough warm bodies for all the great jobs. So that's kind of, you know, something we need to work on as well.
But GT mentioned what Department of Homeland Security's their definition is. They have the 16 sectors that they would define as critical infrastructure. And that's, you know, where we're gonna focus on first. But look, we need to make sure that there are relevant skills, 21st century skills for a 21st century economy. And you know, as other sectors, obviously are created, maybe they don't even exist today. We're not even thinking about it. That we're adaptable and we're making sure that this curriculum, and it deals with anything that might be considered critical infrastructure and IT and operational technology connected, that we're adaptable. And it's forethought rather than an afterthought, as I said.
So, Congressman Langevin, you are the co-chair of the Congressional Cybersecurity Caucus. I'm wondering if you can speak to some of the challenges of educating your fellow members on the nature of the issues here and the urgency of the problem.
Yeah. So, again, it's constant work and effort to just, continue to raise these issues. And, GT and I use our respective positions as co-chairs now of the Career and Technical Education Caucus, and I have a Republican colleague, Mike McCall, he and I created the Cybersecurity Caucus together. And we use these forums as an opportunity to educate members and staff about the issues in these areas. And so we hold briefings, and sometimes it's government experts, sometimes it's industry experts or people from academia, but the caucus is just an opportunity to provide a forum for education of members and staff, and that's what we'll continue to do in this particular issue as well. Again, it's one of those things, if we're silent on it, then nobody's paying attention to it, but this is an area of interest for GT and I, and so we want to bring the relevant experts into the process to make sure we're educating members and staff. I used to get a lot of funny looks, 10 years ago when I started talking about cybersecurity and the damage that could be done, and I felt like one of those little guys with the tin hats running around that the sky's falling. Now everybody gets the importance of cybersecurity, so we're going to use our positions to educate in that area.
Persistence is important on public policy. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of fly-by-night things that happen just off the cuff, and usually it's not the best legislation. It's more emotional than science and data-based. But I find that, and this falls into that category, you have to be persistent. We worked on that Perkins reauthorization literally for 10 years. And sadly, it took 10 years, so we came really close past couple. Close doesn't count unless you're playing horseshoes. And so we finally got it done in 115th Congress. But you got to be persistent on, especially on the things that are important.
Yeah. So you've mentioned a little bit about the focus on the polarized nature of Congress. I'm curious for both of you, how do you think about bipartisanship and sort of its role in cybersecurity education?
It's incredibly important. That's the only way we really get things done that last. And that are sustainable is when we do it in a bipartisan way. And no single party's got a corner on the best ideas. You need to be a willingness to, and I think the Career and Technical Education Caucus actually has been a great example of that. We encourage all, not just our colleagues in both parties, but we engage students, we engage employers, we engage folks that are offering the education, skills-based education, to the table. And I think that is incredibly important with this, that we bring everybody to the table, and then we see what we can agree upon. And I think that's basically what we did I know it's just a pilot, but it's incredibly important with the cybersecurity. That's my perspective on it anyways.
Yeah, and I'll just say, if all you're doing is getting information by watching the high-level things that they're talking about and maybe in the news media, it can be pretty depressing. You think about the polarization of the country. And I didn't discount that there is that the country is divided on ways, and as is the Congress. But there are a lot of areas where we find agreement. And I think by focusing on the things that really matter to the folks back home, bread and butter issues, and this is certainly a bread and butter issue as far as I'm concerned, job training, workforce development. There is bipartisan agreement, and I believe that it starts with us as members of Congress that we've got to work at and be conscious of reaching out across the aisle, finding those areas where we can work together, and certainly GT and I do that. It's one of the really moments of pride that I have in my years in Congress, and talk about accomplishments of what we're making, how we're making a difference in helping people that are in our respective districts. I mean, my partnership with GT has been one of those real highlights that I'm proud to talk about always.
Hey, we got to recognize that we're not always going to agree, too. That's the beauty of the legislative process, is to, we're a diverse nation, and we should celebrate that diversity and those and get all that diversity to the table of ideas and who we are. And I do like to tell people, there are some folks out there that talk with me, and they're just absolutely convinced that friction is an absolute bad thing in Congress, and that we should always agree. And I usually look at them and say, if you think that we should agree all the time on everything, you probably have never been married. Because life just doesn't work that way. You don't always get everything you want. You got to work together, right?
Yeah. That's right.
So I think we have some time for some audience questions. If you raise your hand and wait for the microphone to come to you. It's right here. I'll use moderator's privilege to please ask that it be an actual question.
Yeah. I'm Mike Nelson. I used to teach internet studies at Georgetown. Excellent. I really commend the work that you're doing here to solve one piece of the problem. There's really three market failures. You're dealing with the need for more cybersecurity experts, but last year we had 15 billion records compromised, and 63% of the time it wasn't an insider threat or a malicious hacker. It was insider idiocy.
Yeah.
Somebody did something wrong.
And
so there's two problems: getting the people who run these systems, who often aren't trained in computer science, let alone computer security, more aware of the threat. And the other market failure is getting the IT industry to design things that are easier to use. a lot of people in the field actually want things to be more complicated, so you have to pay them more for consulting. Do you have any solutions to these other two problems, particularly the ease of use problem?
I don't, but I'm sure Jim does.
No, yeah.
Any thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, sure, you know, ease of use is, you know, in the comes in the design, right? That is one of the areas where, you know, America shines really is in our innovation and making things easy to use. And by the way, so another passion of mine is STEM to STEAM. So bringing art and design into the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
And agriculture. Yeah, it's a long A.
All right. And agriculture. When I use the STEM to STEAM example, I think about MP3 players. You know, who the heck used them really as widely until the iPhone came along? And there's an example of how you had art and design incorporated in technology. Just a vivid example of U.S. innovation. So that made technology, if you will, more user-friendly and easy to use. So I guess we have to, you know, be conscious of including user-friendliness into design. The other thing I will say on this in terms of baking security in, backing up more, and as we're developing technology, we have security as a forethought and not an afterthought. And also have a mechanism for closing vulnerabilities, say, after a product is developed. We're doing that in the post-secondary, post-market guidance on medical devices. And there was recently an agreement reached with the FDA and manufacturers, basically, that if as long as you have those mechanisms in place, you avoid the necessary costly things like recalls or other things that can cause problems and it makes it more difficult, after the fact. But if there's both security is built in from the design phase early on as programs are being written and developed, and then also have a way of upgrading afterward that allows for security and safety all incorporated. So being proactive and not just reactive.
And I think the competency of workforce is part of it too. I mean, obviously we're talking career and technical education, but we need in our professional, beyond career and technical education, we need to equip a workforce, those engineers, the people that can, that maybe can help us deal that we don't have those incompetency issues that you referenced. And to be able to, it's always going to be a challenge too. When I practice healthcare, I mean, at that point, technology was changing once every 7 years. Now it feels like it's once every 7 days. And so, but having a really employing and a qualified and trained workforce, highly competent, to be able to be our troubleshooters to help us on those issues. We're not going to deal with all the problems that you talked about completely, but to some degree, the better we do in workforce preparation, not just qualified and trained, but highly competent and effective, could help us, give us tools we need.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your presence and a very informative panel. I'm Margaret Cope. I'm an independent consultant, retired Air Force, worked in aircraft maintenance. I've interfaced, one of the areas that I work on is national service. And I've worked with the academic centers of excellence, both at the university level and at the community college technical school level. And there's a video from Israel showing that Israel has gone from pretty nondescript in the cybersecurity area to being one of the top five. And they use the rationale that they've had the national service program, and that has been enabled them to capture the best talent in this area. Would it be an opportunity for our nation on a bipartisan level to have national service that would include cybersecurity and other areas for our young people?
I think there's opportunities within what we do now with national service, AmeriCorps and others. You know, we ought to be looking at in-demand positions as we deploy people into different types of business industries, agencies. And so, this seems like, again, unless you're someone that's going to live off the grid and keep your money under your mattress and not have a phone or any connection, cybersecurity is going to be a concern of yours at one time or another. And I think it needs to be a part of our we need to look for those types of opportunities as we incentivize various types of education that, it's a highly critical skill. We really haven't talked about how the fact we need to, this is something that it would be great if the states would integrate into their curriculum for secondary school, elementary and secondary schools. I mean, the people that hack my phones more often than anyone else are my 3 and 6-year-old grandsons. It's amazing how they figure out passwords and FaceTime and Twitter and everything else. It's scary, actually. I have to make sure I hide my phones from them. But these kids are sponges, right, at that age. And so if we could start to talk about this as a critical skill set for every American and start actually in our elementary schools with it.
I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. I see a hand there, the green shirt right in the back. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Nikki Rosette Hobner. I'm a school counselor and department chair at Marshall Governor's STEM and CTE Academy just across in Tyson's Corner. It's a secondary school. So we have a robust IT program, over 250 students who would like to take some sort of IT class next year, and we follow kind of along the CompTIA sequence, anywhere from A+ to Security Plus. Training these students. We were actually named a Cybersecurity Center of Excellence by the Air Force Association. But our biggest challenge is finding teachers qualified to be able to teach these students. I mean, to have the content knowledge and then those that are able to inspire students to pursue these types of careers. So I was just curious if there's any, if you guys addressed that at all in your most recent bills or legislation, and then additionally, the funding for setting up some of these highly specialized technical labs for the students to be able to have a safe space to learn cybersecurity without unleashing them on the World Wide Web. So those are the two pieces that I'm just curious if it's addressed in any place.
Well, career and technical education in general, that's one of the issues is finding individuals with the passion to be able to teach, to have that gift of teaching. Kind of sad fact is that, a lot of these are in-demand positions, so sometimes what we pay our instructors is nowhere close to what they could make working in the private sector, practicing their trade, their skill, their profession. And so so that is a challenge. Now, I don't think we directly, but we do indirectly address this because this pilot programming is partnerships between industry and education, employers and educators. And so there are a lot of times, let's think about this. Who are the people that have the most at risk here? It's the employers, right? It's the business and the industries that absolutely need this workforce in order for them to be successful. This is a cost of their business, their reputation, the cybersecurity issues, all the things that can happen. And so the coolest models I've seen, I haven't seen it in cybersecurity yet, okay, because we're just kind of on the cutting edge there, but I've seen it with other industries where employers will place their best employees in these education settings as adjunct faculty members. At no cost to the schools. And sometimes, if they're smart, they'll lend lab equipment or the types of equipment as well. And we certainly encourage that within what we put into the Perkins reauthorization. So it's You know, there is, and Perkins does, as you know, and thank you for your, it sounds like your school's close here. Maybe it's someone, it's one we could come visit here sometime. That'd be great. But with the Perkins monies, you can invest in different types of technology, specifically your program. So there are some dollars that are there as well.
So I'll say this, you know, cybersecurity is an example of that lag between what we're teaching in academia and what businesses need. There are over a quarter million jobs right now that go unfilled every day in the cybersecurity field because people don't have the right skills to do those jobs. That's always going to grow exponentially as time goes on if we don't address this gap. So right now, academia is catching up with cybersecurity. I mean, up until, you know, not too long ago, there wasn't even a program in the field of cybersecurity training. And so it started out with certificate programs and then a master's program. Now it's being created. There's both minors and majors in cybersecurity, but it took time for these programs to really be developed because, the need was there, but there was a lag. So as people go through these programs and are and get the skills, I mean the academic credentialing and training, then there'll hopefully be more people in the workforce that will also be willing to teach these skills. But we're still sort of playing catch up, but we will get there. This particular act doesn't necessarily per se address that specifically, but it will have ancillary positive effects. So thanks for raising it. But we need to continue to develop the workforce. We have all the policies and procedures in place, and we can pass the laws creating things, but if you don't have the people to actually implement them and do the job, that's a real problem and a challenge. So we need to address it as well.
Congressman Thompson, Congressman Langevin, thanks so much for joining
us
today.
Appreciate it.